This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 133. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on this week, Rob?
Well, remember last podcast how I said we were within one day of getting Drip installed on the first paying customer's app?
Yes.
We are still within one day of getting it installed on customer. So here's what we did. It was actually really helpful. We got on a Google Hangout with Derek, myself, and customer number one, and he installed it in the morning and gave us some feedback on the early kind of onboarding, and there were no surprises. I mean, he had little feedback tidbits here and there, but it was nothing that we didn't know, weren't already going to work on, you know, or wouldn't just implement right away. But then he hit a roadblock, a couple things he wanted, like he wanted a sync between Drip and MailChimp because he wants to use MailChimp as his core repository because he just has so much invested there. And then something else dealing with actually creating emails, he wanted more control of images and such. And so these were basically like showstoppers for him. You know, he was like, with these things, I really can't use Drip. And so back to coding, and we are wrapping up both of those features and should hopefully have them installed, you know, within the next 24 to 48 hours. But it was basically a three-hour Google Hangout, and it was amazingly helpful. It was amazingly helpful to hear his perspective on things, like how naming was confusing, how precisely, even though I've had conversations with him, I've emailed with him a dozen times at least about how he was going to use it. There were still, once he got in and started using it, these little nuances that you don't pick up on, and the two small features I just named, they never came up before now. It's a good feeling. I feel much less discouraged. That day I was kind of like, oh man, we're still not on customer one. But now that we're getting back to installing him again tomorrow or the next day, it feels good. It's like we've moved forward. We've made progress since last week.
That's really cool. I mean, I noticed the same thing when I started walking some people through some of the early versions of AutoShark, where there's certain things that are named in a specific way and it just doesn't make sense to people. And there's some of those things are still like that, but there are obviously areas that I've looked at and said, okay, well, I got to go through and make some adjustments here. But yeah, just naming something, as trivial as that sounds, you know, it can make a big difference when the customers get in and they start looking at it. Because if they don't understand what they're looking at, then you have to either educate them or they'll just kind of abandon it because they don't understand, they don't get it.
Right. And I had intentionally let Derek move forward with development and really was not in the app very much. And I did that on purpose so that there would be a fresh set of eyes once we installed it on Hittail. And sure enough, as soon as we got it working, I logged in and I said, oh, you know, we got to move this around, change naming. This is confusing, blah, blah, blah. And I was that first run through of just making it a little more usable. But now, you know, we're what, maybe 3 weeks in, I would guess, 3.5 weeks. And it's starting to become where I'm comfortable with the app and I don't see those things anymore. And so to have another set of eyes, just it gives you perspective. You know, it's that fresh set of opinions. How about you? What's new this week?
Well, I'm still wrapping up a couple of things from MicroConf. I still got to get the survey out. You know, just some paperwork issues other than that. And the hotel just got back to us today and said that, you know, you owe us another $1,800 or whatever.
Yeah, and if you're interested in seeing some photos from MicroConf, go to microconfpics.com. That's microconfpics.com, and that leads to a Google Plus album. We have about 50 pictures of speakers, people hanging out, Mike and I up on stage, and all that kind of stuff. So check it out if you're interested.
Aside from that, I've been doing some more customer development this week with Audit Shark. You know, just reaching out to some more people who are in the security space or already that I know of who have servers that need to be protected, and just trying to work with them to talk to them about Audit Shark and get it installed with them. You know, I've already had some preliminary discussions with them and talked to them about pricing and everything else, and that all seemed fine to them. So hopefully, I got word a few minutes ago, just before this podcast, that the billing code was ready to go out. So it just needs to be tested a little bit. And once that's in place, then I'll start putting these people on and hopefully actually start charging people within the next week or two.
And I say testing schmesting to your billing code.
Yes,
Roll that baby out. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, the thing is, I'm not actually billing. Like, all I'm doing is, I think for the first one, I'll just bill them automatically. And then after that, there's all this other stuff in place that says, oh, well, if your next billing date is this, and the first charge just kind of goes through. And then after that, it's a matter of targeting people for the follow-up recurring billing.
Right. Hey, in line with what you said on the last episode about hiring a bookkeeper, I am in the midst of that. And I interviewed a bookkeeper today as well as last Friday. Found some pretty good candidates. And it was funny, one guy I talked to, he asked me about MicroConf as we were talking. He's like, how'd MicroConf go? And I was like, oh, he must have researched me based on my name. I was just kind of puzzled. And then he told me that he was on the waiting list for MicroConf. It was really funny. Yeah, I was like, wow. I guess we get around. I just wouldn't expect, I mean, you know, he's a remote bookkeeper, but he's just into technology and startups and stuff. And so he had tried to get in and hadn't gotten a ticket. So that was kind of a fun conversation. It actually made me be like, I like this bookkeeper. It's like, if we have similar interests, he's probably going to have a better understanding of my business. And he works with a lot of other smaller software companies and SaaS companies. So, I mean, he's on his own. Like, he works alone. He has a home office. I'm pretty stoked about him, hoping we can work something out. But I also have a few other folks I'm looking at through Odesk.
Very cool. I signed up for a Square account a while back, and I actually gave them enough information for them to send me a Square reader. So I'm going to be using this, hopefully, when talking to people, you know, still when I'm early on with Audit Shark, and say, hey, you know, is this something you're interested in? And, you know, inevitably you get the, yeah, that sounds great. And of course, then there's the question of can I get your email address, or would you pay for it, or will you pay for it? And of course, the next step is actually getting their credit card information. And I've got a Square reader here that they mailed me over the weekend that will allow me to take payment on the spot. And I just thought of that as a great way to start validating ideas. So if anyone has an idea that they're trying to validate, you're asking people if they will pay for it, if they're going to prepay for it. You know, using something like a Square reader seems like a no-brainer, because you've got it right there. You can actually ask them for money and take a credit card payment on the spot.
Very nice. So that would have been cool to have at MicroConf.
I know. I thought of it after the fact.
Yeah. You know, there's another recommendation I can make if you don't have a Square account, is if you have a Stripe account, or even you can open a Stripe account in like 2 minutes. And then there's an iOS app called Paid. And if you search for like Paid Stripe in the App Store, it'll come up. It's $5, I think. It's a really nice app. It looks gorgeous, and it helps you monitor your Stripe account. There's a lot of reports, but then there's also one page where you can just enter a credit card number and charge it an arbitrary amount. So it doesn't have the cool swipey thing, you know, that Square gives you, but it is another way, just right on the spot on your mobile app, to you know, to be able to do that, and you don't have to carry around the extra hardware. So John from bluebridgedev.com commented on episode 130, which was the episode where we talked about unfair advantages. And he mentioned that three additional unfair advantages. The first one, he said, was assets, like a massive savings account, website with good SEO, etc. And I like that. I like, you know, once you've built up some assets of your own, it's definitely can be an unfair advantage against someone who doesn't have those. Second one he mentioned is personal qualities. And I think I'd prefer to be more specific here, but the examples he gave were like public speaking, strong writer, ability to sell. The third he said is a business model, so like recurring or exclusive rights or low overhead. And I would argue that I don't think that's an unfair advantage, because other people can take advantage. You know, unless you're Netflix going against Blockbuster, where like Netflix went recurring and Blockbuster didn't or couldn't because they're an entrenched competitor, then maybe that's an unfair advantage because they can't pivot quickly enough. But if it's just two or three startups going against each other, then you going with recurring, your competitors can easily switch to it. Or you going with having a low overhead, the odds are your competitors can do that too. Now, something like exclusive rights to something, that would be an unfair advantage that other people can't easily duplicate. Those were the comments from John, and we appreciate the feedback as always.
So what are we looking at for iTunes reviews? I saw a bunch of new ones out there.
Yeah, we haven't talked about them in a while. A ton of new reviews, a lot of 5-star reviews. We really appreciate them. Jocelyn Krause says, 5 stars, most useful of all startup-themed podcasts. She says, I've been on a startup-themed podcast listening binge and can confidently say this is the best out of the 24 or so shows I've sampled. If you're looking for advice on how to actually build an online software product, this is the show for you. Keep it up, Mike and Rob, and thank you. Another is from a username that I can't possibly pronounce because it's a bunch of numbers and consonants, but it says, actionable, practical, and accessible. Like most other reviews here say, Rob and Mike do a fantastic job of providing not only tactical advice, but also strategic advice for people who want to start their own business on the side. The icing on the cake is that they release new episodes like clockwork every week. We don't get a lot of comments about that, but you know, we have been consistently, I think we've released an episode every Tuesday morning for the past year. Even the weeks like the MicroConf week, we recorded like an extra episode. And during Christmas week and New Year's week, we record an extra episode. And I think that's something that we both take pretty seriously. And I think it, I'm glad that it, you know, that people notice and that we, there's always something to listen to on Tuesday morning.
Yeah, it's funny because at MicroConf, we were there. I think I was talking to somebody on Monday and they're like, oh, are you going to be recording a podcast episode tomorrow? And we're like, no, we'll probably do it like Thursday or Friday. And they seemed really disappointed. And they're like, oh, I'm not going to get a new episode tomorrow. I'm like, oh, no, you'll get it. We recorded tomorrow's episode last week. We do them about a week in advance. So, yeah, there were people who were at MicroConf who were listening to the podcast.
Yeah, and that was on my plane flight home. I listened to our Tuesday episode as well. Today's episode is based on a question from Stephen Ryan. He's from throwingboulders.com. He's a longtime Academy member and a MicroConf attendee. He emailed me afterwards, and he had a question. He said, should you enter a niche based solely on opportunity, or do you need to have passion and or industry experience with the subject matter? I'm trying to understand where keyword counts, customer development results, etc., stop mattering as much as your passion to execute. And he actually sent several questions to me via email, and instead of writing back with paragraphs of prose, I recorded him a screencast and kind of just talked through some stuff. And before I knew it, I had like 16 minutes of audio. And at the end, I said, you know, this, there's enough meat here that I know we need to talk about this on the podcast and share it with, you know, with the whole community, because it's just, there's a lot of depth to that question. The thing Stephen asks is, should you enter a niche based on opportunity, or do you need to have passion? The first thing I said is, it's not an either-or question. I hate it when people say, oh, you should always do this, you should never do this, this never works, this always works. It just doesn't work that way, right? Those absolutes, they're an easy way to think, you want to think black and white, but they're not reality. And so today's episode, we're titling The Founder Test. And it's, the subtitle is 11 Founder Attributes That Will Determine the Success of Your Product. And then later on, perhaps next episode or in a couple of weeks, we're going to do an idea test. And it's going to be a number of attributes that determine the success of your idea. And the point of these is to say, it's not should you enter a market based on this or that. It's to say it's a gradient. There are 10, or in this case, I guess 11 attributes of you as a founder that all factor into this decision. And the way I like to think about it, it'd be ideal if this was a list of 10, because then you could rank each one on a scale of 1 to 10, and then add them up. And based on if you're at 0 or 100, you can say, well, I think I'm a founder that's, you know, eventually going to succeed or not. And this, you could do the same thing with an idea. So we're going to be talking again about 11 founder attributes. And the first one is your knowledge of the niche or the problem to be solved. So this is much more in line with what Stephen originally asked, was, you know, should you have knowledge? Should you have passion? Should you go in solely based on opportunity? And bottom line is, if you have, on a 1 to 10 scale, if you have a knowledge of your niche or the problem to be solved of a 1, then you need to educate yourself, and you stand less of a chance if someone has equal founder attributes as you, but they have a 10 here, right? That they are in it, they know what they're going to build, their own customer zero, all of those things play into how much success you're going to have. So again, it's not you should never enter a niche that you don't have knowledge of, but it's definitely helpful to, you know, the more knowledge you have of that niche or the problem to be solved.
I think that this is one of those things where you have to take this into account. You have to, when you're looking at the competition and evaluating them as to whether or not you should go in and whether you stand a chance against them head to head, this is something you definitely need to take into consideration, because if they know the niche and you don't, you're going to be at a serious disadvantage regardless of the other resources that you may be able to bring to bear. It's very difficult to overestimate the level of helpfulness that having that knowledge is going to give you.
Attribute number 2 is your technical/programming knowledge. And so we're assuming here you're building a software product. And we're not saying that if you don't know how to code, that you can't successfully launch a software product. What we're saying is that the more technical knowledge, the more programming skills you yourself have, the higher the chance that you're going to be able to deliver a finished software product. This is irrespective of whether you write the code yourself or whether you hire it out. In either case, the more skill, experience, and knowledge you have of programming, the easier it will be for you to actually deliver a finished software product in the end.
I think this matters a lot more if you're the person doing the code than if you're the one who's got knowledge of the problem to be solved. If you have the knowledge of that problem, but you don't necessarily know how to accomplish it, I think that that's a much easier situation than the reverse.
I would agree, because you're right. I know a number of non-technical founders who have intimate domain knowledge, and they know how to solve that problem. And hiring out code, while it's not trivial to do that, it's easier to do that often than it is to learn, you know, a new domain from scratch. So founder attribute number three is your skill as a project manager. And this assumes that you are going to be doing some type of outsourcing or delegation, which is something we recommend. And I think your ability or willingness to outsource and delegate is actually the point after that. Because the more you're willing to hand off to other folks, the more likely you are to complete a finished product, but you have to be able to manage them effectively and have some type of experience or skill with that, or else, you know, projects go off the rails fairly easily, as we've discussed in, you know, the last couple episodes.
I think that your skills as a project manager are crucial to being able to scale up a business, especially when you're trying to scale it up just past yourself, or just trying to take certain pieces of it and say, well, you know, this is too much for me, or I don't want to have to deal with this, or I can't deal with this right now because I don't have the time. Those are the things you have to be able to manage. And if you can't, it's going to put you at a disadvantage to anybody else. But it's critical to be able to develop those skills. And the key point I want to make here is that that's a skill, and it's a learned skill. Just because you suck at it now doesn't mean that you won't suck at it after trying it a couple times. And you do get better at it over time. You do learn from your mistakes. But the first couple of times you try and manage a project where you don't have somebody over the top of you who's trying to push things down to you and say, well, these are the things that need to get done. You know, this is the order that they need to get done. When you're the one calling the shots and you're the one making those decisions, it's very difficult the first time, but it does get easier over time.
Founder attribute number four, as I just mentioned, is your skill with outsourcing and delegating. And I think this comes down to two points. Number one is, do you have experience outsourcing and delegating? And do you have a competent person or people to outsource to that you've already found? Because maybe if you, let's say it's a 1 to 10 scale, a 1 might be you've never outsourced, you don't have any experience delegating, and you have no one to outsource to, and you're going to start by looking on Odesk. And then a 9 or a 10 is someone who has several years of outsourcing experience and already has a virtual assistant or a programmer or a developer or a designer who has extra bandwidth, and they're a known quantity, and you have a known relationship, and your communication is already set. You know, you've already used them, and they're reliable, and they not only do you understand them, but they understand you. Like, they understand the way you work and what your expectations are. And so that would be the 1 to 10 that I would look at in terms of outsourcing and delegating.
I talked to a ton of people at MicroConf who had, I'll say, significant issues with just mentally trying to do outsourcing, because they were always of the mentality, well, you know, it's hard to find somebody, or it takes a long time to find somebody. It would be so much easier, or so much quicker, if I just did it myself. But, you know, when you start compounding those things, you know, on any given project, sure, it's going to take you a lot longer to find somebody and then implement it. But once you get to 2, 3, 4, 5 different things that you have them do, that's when you start seeing those cost savings. It's almost like when you're launching a new product where you look at your revenue, for example, and you have this dip because you've got this initial investment. But then as that starts to rise, as you start to get more comfortable with the person that you've sent stuff off to, or you're gathering money from your product, that starts to rise and you go into the black. And it's definitely a worthwhile investment, but you obviously have to do it right. You have to be using competent people who aren't going to flake out. And it takes a lot of practice in order to get good at it. And I see it just the same as being a project manager. It takes time. It takes effort. You do make mistakes, but you do learn from those mistakes over time and you get better at it.
Founder attribute number five is your passion for the problem to be solved. And I've heard a lot of different arguments about this. Some people say passion is a competitive advantage. Others say passion doesn't have much to do with it. I, like other things on this list, believe that the more passion you have to solve the problem you're trying to solve, that all other things being equal, that you will come out ahead of someone who really doesn't care that much about it, or are just going into it because the opportunity, that, you know, the keyword results and the expected market size and other things looks promising.
I think in some ways this boils down to the amount of success that somebody might foresee coming out of whatever you're undertaking. Because if, as you said, I mean, if the opportunity cost is low and it doesn't take a lot of effort to get into it, then people who have kind of a cursory interest are going to go into it. If they start running into hurdles or roadblocks or anything like that, they may very well just give up because, oh, well, it didn't take me much effort to try and get into it, and I don't really feel like dealing with this. Whereas if you have the passion to solve those problems and really address the market, then you're going to be able to push through those because you don't care about those. You want to get through those. You want to be able to solve people's problems. If you don't care about it as much and you don't have the passion, then you're not going to bother pushing through them. And I could definitely see how that factors into it, but I also think that it has something to do with, you know, what the potential outcome is. Well, you know, what's the upside to this? You might not have a lot of passion for solving the problem, but you might see that there's this massive upside to it where you could reach a lot of your other goals in life and by solving that problem because you can reap a lot of rewards. So I wonder how much that kind of plays into it. You know, it's definitely the difference between doing something because you love doing it versus doing something because you, you know, want the money from it, I'll say.
Right. And I think that's where some people kind of go off the rails on this because just having a bunch of passion for an idea, and if you ignore all those other ones, those success factors, then, and you just go, oh, I'm just so passionate about this idea, but there is no market, and it has a very long sales cycle, and you can't find a single decision maker, and nobody really wants it, it doesn't solve a pain point. Like, if you ignore all those other things, that's where you run into the overvaluing passion and thinking that passion can conquer all. And what we're saying here is, no, it can't. It's helpful to be passionate about it, but it's just one of what we're saying are 11 different factors that kind of compile to figure out whether or not you're going to be successful at this.
Yeah, I totally agree with all that.
Founder attribute number 6 is your ability to build something people want. And to translate this, it's kind of like, are you a product person? Are you an exceptional product person? Do you build awesome UIs? Do you have a lot of experience building apps? Do you have flexibility and the openness to change your idea based on someone's feedback during customer development? If you can really focus and build something people want, and you have that experience, then I put you at a 10 on this one. And if you are not a software person and you've never designed a software app, and I don't mean graphically designed, but done user experience stuff, thought through screens and flow and naming and all the things that make an app easy to use, then you're closer to a 1 on this scale. And so again, this doesn't make or break you. You're going to have to educate yourself and or get a little lucky to build a good app if you don't have much experience with it. Or you can obviously outsource that if you can find someone who's really good at it. They're not going to tend to be cheap, but this is a place where, you know, you can hire expertise that's outside of your own in order to boost your number rating on this one.
I think that the ability to learn from your mistakes probably factors it into it a little bit more than your experience, but the flexibility side of this is probably a lot more important than that as well. I mean, you need to be able to change your idea based on the feedback that you're getting from the customers. You need to be able to adapt and understand that just because you think that you have the right solution doesn't mean that it is the right solution that people are going to pull out their credit cards and buy. It's interesting to look and hear people talk about, oh, well, Steve Jobs didn't talk to customers and this and that. But Steve Jobs is an extreme outlier. I mean, he had this vision of what was going to be and what should be and what people wanted, and he had, you know, the capital from Apple in order to be able to drive that marketing engine to craft the story to make it happen. Not everybody has access to that, and anybody listening to this podcast probably doesn't have access to that kind of resource. So you really have to think about what is it that people are going to pull out their credit cards and pay for versus what is it that you want to build for people, and is that something that people will pay for?
Yeah, that's the thing. We're going to cover the other factors here in a second. One of them is money. And you could say, well, you know, money is on a 1 to 10 scale in terms of how much money you have to fund this startup idea. But as you said, you know, Steve Jobs was worth $1 million when he was 21, $10 million when he was 22, and $100 million when he was 23. By that time, if you look at these founder attributes, certainly he had some of these, right? He had skill and experience and such. But he had so much money that maybe he would get 100 points. Like you and I would get 10 points for, you know, having a decent amount of budget, but he had so much money he could fail over and over and over. And actually he proved that with Pixar. Like he dumped most of his fortune into keeping Pixar alive. And when you have such an outlier case like that, it doesn't necessarily fit into our model that we're doing here. I think, like you said, for most of the listeners, you would fit into that. So founder attribute number 7 is your skill as a marketer. And I would actually say that this is another one that should, the weighting should be doubled, because marketing is maybe even tripled, right? Marketing is such a large part of whether your product's going to succeed. And I think this falls into a number of camps, but one of them is whether you're a creative marketing mind, someone like Seth Godin or Matthew Inman. These are people that are, I bet they aren't looking at their analytics, tracking and measuring every little number and nuance and split testing and all that stuff, but they're just genius marketers. The other side of it is, do you have high skills with analytics, tracking, measuring, split testing? That's more the kinds of things that you know, we've talked about at the analytical marketer, like myself, Patrick McKenzie, Sean Ellis, Heaton Shaw. If you can really nail this part, it can absolutely, it can really tip your scales. You know, it can make it so even a mediocre idea can, it can do well. Now, there's this old saying that great marketing will just make a crappy product fail faster. And I wholeheartedly believe that. So you can't do a crappy product, but if you have a decent product, but you have exceptional marketing, it can make a software product at least a moderate success just by having that overweighting of the marketing chops.
I think that there's two different pieces of this that you have to keep in mind. I mean, because there's the people like, as you mentioned, Seth Godin, where he's got a really great marketing mind and can come up with these, I'll call them outlandish, but typically brilliant ideas of how to go about crafting a story and talking to people. And then there's the other type of marketer who is very much about the analytics and tracking and measuring and incremental tweaking to make that story better. And they leverage what they're learning from that to make their story better versus somebody like Seth Godin, and I would almost classify Steve Jobs in this as well, but you know, they have this vision that they can push out there and kind of make people believe. So I think that those are two different, you know, ways of approaching the marketing side, and they don't necessarily overlap a lot. I mean, there's a spectrum there, and you fall somewhere in that spectrum, and it's just how far towards one or the other do you fall and at what intensity.
Attribute number 8 is who you know. And while this may not sound like a personal attribute, it really comes down to, do you naturally build a lot of relationships? And do you have that Rolodex where you can call on folks to help you and either give you feedback or to leverage your network to help you promote the product or help make it a better product or to integrate with? I mean, there's just so many valuable things you can do. This actually goes back to our unfair advantage episode, where we talked about how just having that unfair advantage of a large Rolodex can, in fact, tip the scales in your way of success. Now, you need to have reasonable ratings for the rest of these, but having a really big network and knowing a lot of people, you know, can definitely be a big benefit.
I think the area where this really comes into as a benefit is the types of people you can go to just ask questions. And if you're the type of outgoing person where you can go out and meet new people, you're in a decent situation. But at the same time, if you just have a large network of people who know you or you know them, you can approach them and say, hey, I've got this problem. Can you help me out? Or, you know, can you offer me some advice? You've already got that built-in relationship. You know, it basically greases the wheels. It makes it easier. It makes it quicker for you to iterate through that process as opposed to having to introduce yourself to people in order to get their feedback and opinions on stuff.
Attribute number 7 is time. If you have 5 hours a week to work on your idea, give yourself a 1. If you have 80 hours a week, give yourself a 10. Time doesn't always make people be more productive or more effective, but it absolutely can make a difference, all other things being equal. And of course, you can tip it too far, right? And if you work 80 hours a week every week, your productivity over the long haul goes down. But having the flexibility to put in longer weeks when needed versus the person who can only work 5 hours, it will tip the scales, all other things being equal. Attribute number 10 is money. And I mean, this comes back to the Steve Jobs thing we said a little earlier, but even on a smaller scale, you know, if you have basically no money saved up to fund this app, or you only have $20 a month that you can spend on it, you're going to have to move slow. And this is a disadvantage. And that would be a give yourself a 1. Whereas if you have someone who saved up to even $10,000 or 20 grand, they are definitely at an advantage. And you don't need a ton of money to do it. I mean, we're not talking about raising money here. We're talking about having either a few thousand bucks saved up to help you with outsourcing, gaining of knowledge, marketing, and not having to worry about little expenses like hosting and credit card fees and all that kind of stuff. And it also allows you just to move a lot faster. You can get an app coded and done twice as fast or more if you're able to outsource pieces of it, or if you're able to hire a developer 20 hours a week instead of 10 hours a week, or you're able to buy out some of your time. You know, if you're consulting and you can consult less because you have X extra income coming in every month, or you have a block of money that you've put away, then you can just move faster. And that always winds up being a success factor, because not only are you able to get to market faster, but the quicker you can get to real people using your app, the quicker it benefits you mentally. I mean, we talk a lot about how psychology is a big part of launching an app, and not getting discouraged is a big piece of that. I don't know if I've said this on the podcast before, but I have this thing that I say, funded companies go out of business because they run out of money. Bootstrap companies go out of business because they run out of motivation. The only time you're going to close up shop is when you lose motivation, because you don't have any money coming in the first place, right? So it's not a matter of missing payroll. There is no payroll. So that's where having some money to speed along the process and get to market quicker can help keep you focused and on the rails. And so you don't just eventually kind of lose motivation and shut the thing down out of disappointment.
You know, I think I look at the money side of this a little bit differently. I mean, one of the things that I look at is, how are you able to mentally justify spending the money that you do have? I think that having the money is only one piece of it, but having the mentality of saying, okay, I'm going to pay $20 a month for this because it's going to get me where I need to go faster, versus the people who sit there and think, well, why should I pay $20 for that when I know that I could do that myself, or I could hack together a solution that would do that and it wouldn't take too much longer than I'm already spending to do that. Part of it's about time management, but it's about managing your resources to be able to get things done faster and move yourself towards your goals quicker. If you're not willing to part with some of that money and use it as an investment in your future, then chances are really good that you're going to have trouble with that down the road. And there's going to be a huge number of roadblocks in your way that you're putting there because you're not willing to make that investment in yourself.
Founder attribute number 11 is focus. Do you have the ability to not chase after shiny objects and to focus on one thing long enough to bring it to market? Hopefully that's 4 to 6 months. Then to go through the learning phase, hopefully that's 3 to 6 months, and then to grow that thing. And that may take another 6 to 12 months. So mentally, when I start a project, I always say the next 18 to 24 months, I have to focus on this. And I may do other things, right? We put on MicroConf. And yes, that does take a little bit of time, a lot of time over the course of a couple months, but then it's done. And now I refocus and put all my energy into that single project. You'll notice that right now I'm not looking at releasing a second edition of my book or writing another book. I'm not looking at starting another podcast. I'm not looking at launching a different app. I really am talking most about keeping Hittail going and getting Drip launched, because those are the things I'm focusing on. All the other things I just mentioned are things on my long-term to-do list, but I'm not bouncing around and trying to do all of them at once. I know that they're on my long-term roadmap and that I will get to them eventually. And so, like I said, founder attribute number 11, how well do you focus?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the reasons that I cut back on some of my yearly goals. I mean, I think at the very beginning of the year, I said, oh, I want to write a book by the end of the year and have it out late summer. And I actually decided to completely kill that a little while ago. So that's one of those things that I just said, look, you know, I can't concentrate on that now. And even though it's a long-term goal, I've got to push that off. I can't even think about that right now just because it's taking up space in my brain. And then I've got a couple of signs around my office that just say one word, that's just focus in giant letters, so that when I look up from my monitor, I look around and I see that. It's just a reminder to me that if I look around and I start to get distracted, I see that and say, oh, you know what? You've really got to focus on the things that you're working on right now. And whatever those happen to be, you need to be able to leverage your time effectively. And I think one of the things that people run into when they're trying to shift from a consulting business into a product business is they think in the back of their minds, oh, well, I could spend 2 hours doing client consulting work and I'll make X dollars, or I could spend some time over here, you know, the same amount of time, and I may or may not get a return on it. And that's not really the right way to look at it. I mean, you really have to be focused on those long-term goals and understand that everything you do is an incremental improvement on the previous things that you've done. And if you're not working towards that goal, I mean, if you're not making those incremental improvements, it's never going to improve. You're never going to find this thing that where you change some text on your website and it magically converts 300% better. It just doesn't happen. You're going to have to continue doing these incremental improvements and tweaks in your business to try and figure out what works, what doesn't. And focusing on your products, focusing on the goals that you have, and just going through the daily processes or the weekly processes that you've put forward to move you towards your goals is what you need to focus on.
When I was putting this list together, there are a couple other factors that I had in there, but they're almost so fundamental and so general that I didn't want them in the list, but they're honorable mentions. And I'll list two of them here. One is, do you get things done? Like, are you actually effective when you're sitting there working? Because I know people that may be a good project manager and decent developer, and they have a passion for a project or a product, but when they sit down to do things, they aren't that effective. They actually don't move the project forward. And so if you don't do that, then that's almost like a non-starter. That's actually you have to figure that out or you're never going to get this project done. The other one is persistence. And again, it's like such a generality, but I've seen people start building an idea and then at the first roadblock or the first sign of a speed bump of any kind, they just say, well, this isn't going to work. Maybe this whole entrepreneur thing, you know, is just more than I want to get into. Yeah, you're not persistent enough. You probably shouldn't even get into this game because you're going to have a lot of failures. You're going to have to deal with that, and you're going to have to kind of get over them, learn from them, and get better the next time. So I guess these are less honorable mentions as I'm talking about them, and they're more like fundamental attributes that you need to have sorted out before you even get to, you know, the 11 we just talked about. Because if you don't have either one of those, the get things done and the persistence, the odds of you even getting to launch are very, very low.
So as a follow-up question, some people might be thinking to themselves, am I unprofessional if I draw inspiration from scratching my own itch? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's what Stephen had said. It was another question he had asked. I think the question of unprofessional is not the right one to be asking, but it's more like, am I making a good decision if I scratch my own itch or not? There's a lot of talk about this, right? About people who want to solve their own problems because 37 Signals did that. Right? And they did it back in 2005, 2006, and then they talked about it. And they kept saying, you should scratch your own itch, and if you're not doing that, you're going to fail. And that's the attitude that I don't agree with, right? Because they're saying it's an all or nothing thing. You will always fail if you don't scratch your own itch, and scratching your own itch dramatically increases the chance of success. I think it does increase it. I just don't think it's an either or proposition. I guess it comes down to, you don't have to scratch your own itch. I do think you have a higher chance of success. However, there's a trick here. They started doing that in 2006, and they built Basecamp and HiRise and all these other things. Well, it's 2013 now, and hundreds, if not thousands, of developers have been scratching their own itch. So all the low-hanging itches have been scratched. So you have to think at a higher level now. You can't just go out and build a basic SaaS project management app. You have to have some unique piece to it. So I would say, yes, scratch your own itch. Go do that. But figure out a way to scratch that itch in a way that no one else has before. You have to have a novel approach to it. You have to have a novel way to market it. You have to have some type of value prop that will get you heard above the din, rather than just saying, well, I have a problem. Look, I solved it. And then trying to figure out how to market it. Because that's something we see a lot, right? With entrepreneurs who come, either ask for advice, they come into the academy, just meeting day to day. I know that people build a product to solve a single problem. That unto itself is a problem. Because then you find yourself, 6 months in and you haven't really validated that there is a need. So I guess it's like scratch your own itch, but validate that hundreds, if not thousands of others also have that same itch before you write a line of code.
I agree with you. I don't think that it's unprofessional in any way. But, you know, as you said, there's since 2006, a lot of those personal itches that people have had have been scratched. And I think that if you were to look around and start asking the people who went down that road, I think you'd also find a lot of people who failed miserably because they didn't validate that there was a market. I don't think that scratching your own itch is in any way, shape, or form going to be an indicator of success. It's the market. Is there a market? Are there people willing to pay for it? And if you don't take that into account before you try scratching your own itch, before you even write that first line of code, then it doesn't really make a difference because you're not going to be able to turn it into a full-time income. That said, you know, it's fine if you take some sort of side project that, you know, was reasonably well done and you didn't necessarily want to productize it or weren't trying to productize it when you first built it. And, you know, then you look around and you say, huh, is this a product? Is this something people are willing to pay for? And in fact, I think that that's how Fog Creek ended up with FogBugs. I mean, Joel had this piece of code laying around that he'd built to do bug tracking, and they decided that they would ship it. And they cleaned it up and shipped it out, and people loved it, and that turned into their flagship product. And that's what they're known for today. So it's not to say that you can't do something like that. It's just that, you know, if that's something that you did a while back, make sure that you validate that there is a market for it.
So that's what we call the founder test. It's 11 founder attributes that will determine the success of your product.
So the first founder attribute is knowledge of the niche or problem to be solved. Number two is technical or programming knowledge. Number three is your skills as a project manager. Number four is your skill with outsourcing or delegating. Number five is your passion for the problem to be solved. Number six is your ability to build something that people want. Number seven is your skills as a marketer. Eight is who you know. Number nine is available time. Number 10 is money. And number 11 is focus.
Oh, and by the way, before we head out, we are putting on a microconf in Europe. It's going to be in Prague in October. October 5th and 6th. If you're interested in hearing more as details pan out and we find more speakers, go to microconfeurope.com, add your email to that list, and we'll definitely be in touch. Right now, Mike and I are the only confirmed speakers, but we have a short list that is looking quite attractive. So if you have any inklings about going, head to microconfeurope.com and give us your email. If you have a question for us, call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. See you next time.